the United States versus Larry Court.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I was appointed to represent Mr. Court in form of papyrus to pursue this appeal. The question before the Court is, does the record as it exists in this case sustain the conclusion that the government met its burden to establish that Officer Tina Stewart's, her reliance on an inadequate search warrant was objectively reasonable? Now, in analyzing that question, I think it's important to take note of some significant facts. Contrary to my counsel's assertion that we knew what the officers were doing all evening, that is not correct. We have two significant gaps in the sequence of events leading up to the issuance of the search warrant. Gap number one. It's about 4:15 in the morning or thereabouts when Officer Sturz transports Abe Savage. Abe Savage is the informant who is identified in the affidavit. She transports him to the Chippewa County Jail. The next piece of information we have is that 701 Circuit Judge Cameron signs a search warrant. We have approximately 2.5 hours of missing time. The importance of that is it is during that time that the warrant application process takes place. And as I asserted in my brief, we don't have any information about the warrant application process. All we have is the affidavit itself. That's gap number one. Gap number two occurred slightly earlier.
Does that gap, do you think, reflect that the police were reckless? Or I'm trying to see what the significance of that is.
The significance of that is as follows. Leon has indicated that we should look at not only the execution of the warrant, but also the warrant application process. And it is that gap that deals with the warrant application process. Did Investigator Stewart run this affidavit by someone else in the department as to its sufficiency? Did she call the Chippewa County District Attorney's office?
At 4 o'clock in the morning?
At 4 o'clock in the morning.
Oh. You made a point of that, you know, they might be able to get some law clerk on his way home or something, but I doubt that they'd be able to get...
Well, Your Honor, as a former prosecutor, I know that I had received calls at 3, 4 in the morning from law enforcement.
From drunks or who?
Pardon?
From people who were intoxicated.
No, from officers seeking advice on a search warrant and the validity of the search at all hours. Typically, most DA's office have somebody on call each particular evening and through the weekend to answer issues such as these. Also, what's missing is what colloquy took place between Officer Sturz and the judge. That all goes to when we evaluate whether her reliance on the magistrate's decision is objectively reasonable, those are all facts that address that issue. I'm not suggesting recklessness in any sense of the word. I am not pursuing the Franks issue on this particular appeal. Gap number two occurs slightly earlier. Gap number two in the information occurs, the record shows that Investigator Sturz advised Savage of his rights at about 1:54 or thereabouts. And then he commences this interview with Investigator Sturz and Officer Cragen, which, for lack of a better description, morphs. When I say morphs, it changes in its character and its content. Well, I haven't used drugs for a number of months, too. Well, I used them last weekend. You can't make me responsible for those drugs. Those are the tenants at my house. So there's a fair amount of change going on. At some point in time between 1:54 and 4:15, law enforcement goes to the house, my client's residence, and there's no information about what occurs there. And the point of that is, what's missing there is the independent cooperation. Savage had given Sturz and Cragen, oh, they've got a Rottweiler in the backyard. They've got a camper on the land. They've got a garage with open stalls. There's nothing to indicate that they verified this information. And that really bespeaks a bigger problem in this case. And that is the amount of independent cooperation that they attempted to do here. There isn't any. Absolutely nothing, at least nothing that we know of. They drove out to the house. Well, that doesn't tell us anything. What observations did they make when they were at the house? Was this information verified that Savage had given them about the dog, about the stalls? We don't know any of that. That's gap number two. It's important to remember that Officer Sturz had three roles here. She was a participant in the interview of the informant. She was the applicant on the search warrant, and she directed the execution of the search warrant. We don't have the situation as we did in U.S. v. Dickerson, where the officers executing it knew a variety of information, substantiating probable cause, sent an officer back to get the warrant, came back with the warrant, had no idea that that officer failed to allege the facts that they all knew. We have someone who is in every step of the process. And that person, we have to assume, the law tells us, that they have a knowledge of well-established legal principles, right? I mean, it's repeated over and over. Well, she's making the application for the warrant. She's supposed to have knowledge of well-established legal principles. There's no independent cooperation. Okay, that may or may not defeat an affidavit under every set of circumstances, but it certainly is a threshold evaluation. What independent cooperation have they made? And having made none, then she should have realized that establishing Savage's reliability for the court was crucial. Bring Savage in to testify in front of Judge Cameron. That was an option. That was
that time of the day. How big is Bloomer, Wisconsin?
I don't know the exact population
of
Bloomer. It cannot be over 1,000 people.
Right. It's a very small community, isn't that right?
Exactly.
Do they have their own DA?
Yep.
Or is it just for that county?
It's for the county, and they have an assistant as well, and two circuit judges. Because one
in
circuit
that county.
Right.
Yeah. Bloomer is just the smallest community in the county.
Well, right? It's one of the smaller in the county, yes.
It's a wide bend in the road, practically.
They have two circuit judges. One circuit judge earlier in the evening had signed the search warrant for Savage's house. The other one, Judge Cameron. So there was obviously enough time. Judge Cameron was available. You can bring the informant in. I mean, if you know that you haven't corroborated the information from the informant, then you got to show why you believe the informant. And that just wasn't done in this case.
What are you asking for here? A suppression hearing or what?
Well, my initial point is...
No, what are you asking for now? What do you hope to get out of this case?
Reversal of the court's decision that...
And a suppression hearing?
No, that's in the alternative, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay.
Good morning. Timothy O'Shea for the United States. I'd like to address first, Your Honors, these two gaps, purported gaps, very briefly, and the long night of the investigation where they're investigating three different sets of people. That's August 30th into the early morning hours of August 31st. Let's deal chronologically with the gaps. What Mr. Meyer calls gap two is 1:54 a.m. to 4:15 in the morning where they're driving around, the officers are driving Mr. Savage around. And Mr. Meyer now complains that they should have independently corroborated Mr. Savage by what they saw at Mr. Corr's residence that night. Usually in Wisconsin, in August, between 1:54 a.m. and 4:15 in the morning, it was pretty dark. I'm not so sure they would have been able to say that there were, you know, the house was the way Savage described the house, the outbuildings were such, there was a dog there, and so on. So I think that gap is sort of a non-issue. The second gap is as Investigator Sturgis begins to transport Mr. Savage at 4:15 a.m. to the Chippewa County Jail, which is in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin, not a very long distance, but about 20 minutes or so from the town of Bloomer, to the Chippewa County Jail till 7:01. You know, these purported gaps. There's no suggestion that it in the middle of the night, after being up all night, that there's that Investigator Sturgis then decided to frame Mr. Corth. Rather, you know, I think we can reasonably assume that she spent that time figuring out what was found in the Savage residence at 806 Rough Place, who said what, and so on, and trying to get her thought together. Maybe she's, you know, got an Egg McMuffin or something, but there's no suggestion that she did anything improper, reckless, or dishonest during that period of time. So I think these gaps are really kind of a non-issue.
What about the warrant application process? I mean, who had the burden to put forth that evidence, and why wasn't that evidence presented?
Well, let me deal with the burden first, and then why it was. Judge Mannion here wrote the Fairchild opinion that says the burden is on the defense. Judge Coffey here joined in the Brown opinion that says, again, that the defense must disprove good faith. And I respect it. I believe that stems from Leon. Here where we have a judicially approved search warrant, in Leon what they said is that judicially approved warrant in and of itself will normally suffice to establish good faith. So the fact that they went through all this normally shows, you know, you went to a judge. You laid out your facts, and if there's no proof that the judge is you know, has abandoned his role, then that will suffice. The second point is there was no need for an evidentiary hearing here. Attorney Meyer did two long affidavits with attachments that really did lay out what happened that long night of that investigation. Those affidavits were submitted without qualification in support. So I guess I'm getting to the second part of the court session. There were facts there, Your Honor. There was no suggestion that the facts were improperly used. Attorney Meyer at no point suggested that an evidentiary hearing should be taken. He excavated from one of his briefs an aside about that they should have had a hearing as to the fencing, but he never suggested, requested an evidentiary hearing as it related to the Frank, the good faith issue. Abraham Lincoln tells a story about a merchant who shortchanged a customer. And as the customer walks away, the merchant realizes his mistake and that he now has this person's money. He picks up a sponge and taps at the window to get the person's attention. That fails. Attorney Meyer has to do more than just tap at the window with a sponge, and he didn't even do that below. You know, you have to give the district court judge an opportunity anyway to make the record, and the defense certainly didn't do that. And as I've indicated, this court's opinion indicates that the burden is on the defense, and it's, as I've indicated, in this particular instance, it's not a necessary corollary that we have to have an evidentiary hearing because there are lots and lots of very detailed facts in the record. That said, you know, the district court was right in deciding that the officers relied in good faith on the affidavit. The affidavit was not devoid of probable cause. You know, Mr. Savage, first of all, there was methamphetamine and marijuana from court on at 806 Rough Place, the first search warrant in the night. And that came from Mr. Court. Abe Savage, you know, late told the officers that he'd been at Court's home the night before and had seen 150 pounds of marijuana, 2 pounds of methamphetamine, a large bag containing cocaine and $300,000. He also described that Mr. Korth is a member of the Iron Wings motorcycle gang and said that he'd seen a lot of guns there, including a machine gun. You know, Mr. Savage's statements are reliable, I submit, because they were first-hand observations, some of which were against his penal interest, and he was trying to curry favor with the law enforcement officers. There's a built-in disincentive to lead officers on a wild goose chase when you're trying to gain their goodwill. So in light of all this, I respectfully submit that that Judge Crabb was correct in determining that the officers acted in good faith. If there are no other questions, I will take a seat. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. How long do you have? 50 seconds. We'll add 10.
All right. Thank you. Briefly on the burden of proof question, Your Honors. Leon stated in one part of its opinion that the government should be able to prove the existence of good faith. It is that phraseology which has led the First, Second, and Fifth Circuits to clearly delineate that the burden of proving good faith is on the government. Logically, there is support for this. Most exceptions in the suppression context are the government's burden. I had a burden. The burden was to establish that the search warrant affidavit failed to state probable cause. I also had the burden if I wanted to pursue a Franks issue. I failed to meet the Franks burden with the district court. I did meet the burden as to the sufficiency of the search warrant affidavit, i.e. it was insufficient. The burden should be on the government. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel, and thank you for accepting the appointment. Thank you, Tom.
Sure.